Awesome to welcome Shoot XP founder Mark Upton to the Basketball Podcast. Mark Upton is a globally respected coaching and skill acquisition expert with over 2 decades of experience shaping youth sport and learning design. Throughout the 2000s, Mark worked with professional teams, national sport organizations, and institutes of sport, helping coaches build game-like learning environments and understand athlete development through performance systems and skill acquisition science. In 2010s, Mark's influence grew through the thought leadership and blogging, where he challenged traditional coaching methods and advocated for nonlinear pedagogy, deliberate play, and practices that foster decision-making and adaptability. By the late 2010s, Mark embraced a neo-generalist philosophy, expanding his focus beyond sport to include systems thinking, organizational development, and human learning. In the 2020s, Mark founded Shoot XP, a basketball development platform that integrates skill acquisition science, technology and analytics to support youth players, coaches, and families.
Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage or see which four athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of two or three players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more.
Mark, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks, Chris. Really looking forward to this.
Man, I messaged you and we've messaged a few times, but I have to say just to the audience, you're one of my earliest influences in this space of skill acquisition. When I first discovered all this during my master's, obviously I was looking for people that were doing practical things in this space and sharing practical things rather than just theoretical. And you were one of the first, and I'll reference a blog for you, Coffee with Mark Upton, which I think was Mark O'Sullivan stuff was the idea, right?
That's right.
But the quote that stood out, and I'd love for you to start talking about this, but children do not play like they used to. That particular piece, that particular part that came out of that blog really stuck with me, because when I really thought about that, I realized how different it is and how much this survivorship bias still exists in us about the way things used to be versus the way they are. And Mark, I cannot say it enough. I'm so happy you're here talking to us.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, that would have been Mark O'Sullivan. He's another great guy to talk to, passionate, obviously, with children's sport, especially. That was maybe 2013 or so, if I remember.
It was definitely in that area, 2010.
Yeah, around that time, which was probably, I guess, my transition of thinking as well, having I'd worked in professional sport here in Australia, actually in Australian rules football. So despite having a kind of basketball background growing up, never at any level, but played and watched the game a heap. Actually, my first kind of role in professional sport was in Aussie Rules. So I worked in that for about 10 years. But then my son, who's just heading off to school at the moment, we're talking about, has just been allowed on out on the road. He's 17 now. Around that time, he would have been 4 or 5 or so. And so it was that shift in thinking going from the top end of adult professional sport more to what are kids experiencing these days, and having been exposed to some of that, like skill acquisition, how we learn, journeys towards expertise, those sort of things. It was an interesting kind of shift in perspective during that period.
We're going to talk about that period, and we're going to talk about some of the things that came out of that period for you and for me. But because I think in a way we're still fighting the good fight, I think, in some ways, that there's still, again, a lot of minds that I think we're altering and we're pushing and we're challenging to think different, but there's still a lot of minds that are stuck a little bit. And I think the key part about what you said is, what is the experience like for the young athlete? And if we all reflect on that, I think we come up with a better product, don't we, generally?
Great point. I think, again, in that shift, getting that young person's perspective, I think the few things that really hit home were probably car rides, so more as a parent. So again, that shift from being a coach and or a specialist coach, analyst, skill act kind of person working with top level athletes, but they're all 20 plus years of age. But then it's the car ride home with my son and maybe his mate after the soccer game when they're 9, 10 years old, and you're just listening in and really hearing their perspective of what the experience is and what they enjoy, or when maybe the coach at times does step over the line or not quite get it right, which we all do. No one's perfect. That It was probably those car rides home, and just more as a parent, gave me a much better perspective on coaching as well. Because probably to start out, it was that probably, I guess, fairly typical when you're still relatively, say, young man or woman going into a profession. It's probably still a bit about you, like thinking, how do I get success? And maybe a bit instrumental. But I think that was an important shift for me, and just having that bigger picture about we're coaching people and what we're talking about here, particularly young people, just the care that you need and the upskilling in knowledge of how do we create the best environment possible for young people.
And you've been in both those environments, tons of professional environments and tons of youth environments now. And there is a difference. Can you talk about that difference? Because we tend to get, especially in America, we treat youth sport like it's adult sport.
It's the same in Australia. There was only something that yesterday I was reading that exactly that, Chris, was we create these the adult environment, particularly around competition, and it's finals time here in basketball in Australia. Yeah, so I was talking about a kids' basketball final that adults again were just getting probably a bit too carried away and caught up with it. But again, which is understandable though. It's very easy to see how, and again, I've got caught up. And you do hear that. I don't know what your perspective is, Chris, but I guess the argument is we need to prepare kids. It's a tough world out there, and they need to learn how to survive or cope in these environments. And I think, yeah, at some point in time, that idea of being a bit more challenged or not totally comfortable for a young person, absolutely, there's going to be a time and place for that. But I think, particularly with younger kids, again, what I will speak here, whether it's a parent or some of the research that is done, that supportive environments generally that are caring, have strong positive relationships between adults and children, the children themselves, that sets a pretty solid foundation, I think, for then some progressing into some of those more challenging situations that sport can create later on.
There was one particular blog where you laid out three common problems in player development, which I just want to dive into a little bit deeper. And maybe we'll go one by one through them because I think it's relevant for people to be able to just hear these perspectives from your point of view. And the first one was too much copy and paste.
Which that's actually in more recent times, again, that's probably a Marco Sullivan term. I know he's written a paper around copy and paste. And these were probably observations that in more recent years, particularly with basketball, but also again, whether it's soccer, Australian rules, rugby, hockey, kind of team sports in general, I think maybe these things apply. Maybe when you're starting out on your coaching journey, had a lot of talk about this, about it is a bit of copy and paste, and maybe that's okay. But at some point, I think if you want to be a really good coach and create the best environment, then that idea that you need to, within a team or group context, individualize it as best as possible, particularly when it's longer term player development. So if we're working with youth or even pros in their starting out their career that is still a few years from being at peak performance, how do we individualize it to their needs and design practice sessions around that? And that takes some time, some thought, and some creativity, and obviously some knowledge. So talk about the whole area of skill acquisition, and certainly in Australia, we've had skill acquisition specialists. Like at times, I think that can help, but I don't often think that's the key rate limiter. I think it is just some time and thought, and how do you craft out a bit of space to really put some of that into your practice design?
So for me, what I'm curious about is then how do we do that? How do we better account for individual differences as a coach?
Good question. I think there's the other saying I used the other day was like, how do we individualize but not decontextualize? I guess obvious ways, and particularly in basketball, isn't it? Is okay, if we want to do individual development, we tend to do like a one-on-one session. So it's just that player and maybe a skills coach, trainer. And so we do this kind of one-to-one work, which can be fine, and there can be a need to do that. But that often is, yes, we've individualized, but maybe then the types of situations and the way we are practicing skills or working on certain things is somewhat decontextualized because there's just that one player there. Other end extreme, we've got the full team training session where, yeah, we get context, game, representativeness, if you like, but questionable, do we actually hit the needs of that player or can they get enough repetition? So for me, the sweet spot, and this regardless as well of I think of what kind of theories or frameworks you might use. This could, whether it's your advocate of a more constraints approach, small sided games, game sense in Australia. I think the sweet spot is in that middle, kind of between those two poles. And I think it starts actually then with a lot of your planning, more like a yearly type plan, is how do we get that sort of session in our weekly schedule, and when can we get it in? Like, it starts probably at that macro level. And then if you can get some of those sorts of sessions in that are smaller group maybe, and then it's okay. And then what's the specific need? So we've got four or five players here. What are their needs? And then you get into how do we manipulate the constraints or design the game to get what we want or they need? And then how are they progressing? How are we going to track it? All those sorts of, you'd probably call, common sense questions that don't have to be particularly sophisticated or even that sexy, but it's probably just, again, find the time to do it consistently.
Mark, I love talking about this because I think one of my challenges when I talk to basketball coaches, particularly even open-minded ones about the constraint-led approach, they tend to get stuck in kind of the team task constraints rather than all these other possibilities, particularly around individual constraints, which you just alluded to. Can you go a little bit deeper for us on that?
Yeah, great point, Chris. I think it's really important because arguably sticking to the constraints framework and the key concept is the interaction of, yes, the task, like you just described it, and the broader environment, but the player, specifically the player, and the interaction of all those three. And I agree, and I've seen similar things, is we probably often forget the player and the environment. It's just very task focused and can become generic. And I think from my experiences directly and also other skill acquisition people and coaches who applied it, when you do get it right with considering the individual and the interaction of the task and the individual's constraints and design something around there. And this is whether it is either an individual sport, which is obviously easy, or a team sport like basketball. That's where you can get some real bang for your buck, I think. And that could be as easy as it sometimes. It's just considering the individual is, or just put them in a different role. Like, we might play them at the point. If they need to get involved in more pick and roll with the ball, we'll just play in point guard, but they might normally play small forward. So arguably, that is an individual constraint, is the role that you're getting them to play, which is exposing them to maybe situations that they need to be put in. I think you go further when it's, is it a specific rule for an individual? So they can only, again, they might be quite a good shooter, you're playing a 3-on-3, but maybe they, and if, let's say, typically right-hand shooters are probably stronger off the dribble to their left hand generally, maybe it's they have to shoot going right off the dribble and can only shoot threes going right off the dribble, for example. And again, there's an endless array of individual constraints you can think about as well. How do we maybe restrict people physically? There's times there's been like weight vests you can use if you want to get more and more intricate, but it all comes back to intention and the purpose of it. So that's probably maybe another trap in a way. So you allude to just generic team constraints, but another one is just throwing anything, any constraints in there and being crossing your fingers rather than being quite intentional and purposeful again about what's the individual need. And that's probably then where the next level of going into this is you need to probably understand some of the principles. So is it, am I using this because we want to encourage a bit more variability or exploration, say, in their shooting? Again, so that's why I'm going to use X, Y, or Z constraint in this case.
So I go a few places with that, and I'll give you a quick example. I had a camp recently where we had an early mature in that kind of seventh, eighth grade level, and he was significantly taller than everyone else at the camp. And for his own development, I said, listen, you're not allowed to go in the paint. Floor is lava, so to speak, in the paint. So then he was able to understand, okay, wait a minute, I can go dominate inside, but that's what my coach always tells me to do. So if you really want to develop, you got to play outside a little bit. The other one that strikes me, as you just said all that, is the importance of sometimes a certain player is going to get coverage. Let's say an older player, scouting report, they're going to get covered a certain way. So giving them that constraint allows them to explore the way another team's going to cover them. So those are two more examples that kind of go with that. And Mark, your examples are tremendous because I think people need to hear some practical examples of these type of things.
Yeah, and it's messy. The other thing that jumps to mind, mate, is I remember a couple of years ago taking some, there's probably between 8 and 12 year olds, a group of those, and again, thought I'd done the right thing. So before the session, lowered the hoops down to 8 foot. So lower hoops, got the size 4 and 5 balls, bit of a mixture depending where they're at. Of course, they get in. They're not interested in the 8 foot hoops. We want to shoot on the 10 foot hoops, just the pros do. And so, again, this is all part of it as well. I thought that was quite intentional and a good approach of manipulating some task constraints.
No, but we cannot convince people to lower hoops and use smaller balls even off the
Yeah, even kids, it turns out.
I know.
We ended up with one end was the 10 foot hoop, the other was the 8. And as the session unfolded, because they could switch. The kids, kind of
I say this sarcastically, but did you know it's not real basketball if you don't play on the real size hoops, even when you're coaching 5-year-olds?
Yeah.
We'll move on from that, Mark. But no, I love those examples and diving deeper in terms of this. But I think another thing that you mentioned of the three common problems in player development, the thing that kind of the reason I have a business at this point is the practice to game transfer. Right? That a lot of things that we do in practice don't transfer. And there's a lot of resistance still to some of this because we have all these traditional drills in sports that worked for me and that's how we did it. And that's worked for me and keeps coming back to that. It worked for me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but is there a better way? So talk to us a little bit of this challenge of kind of your thinking around practice doesn't transfer to games.
Again, it would be across team sports, and it is the ultimate test. So Rick Shuttleworth, who is another skill act specialist at AIS, had worked over in England with heavily in rugby, now more coach development. He's in Singapore. He said, if you want to narrow it all down, that's a business we're in. It's the transfer game, especially once you get to that elite level or working with players that aspire to play at that sort of level. Ultimately, we want things we do outside of the game or the match context to maximally transfer to in-game performance. And so the transfer idea is key. And to be the ultimate pragmatist, whatever maximizes transfer is good in terms of what we're doing outside the game. But there seemingly are some common things that increase those chances, if you like. And I'm just, again, there's so much to unpack, Chris, with this one, why do or don't things you do transfer. I think over time, I learned, again, go to even Australian rules football, probably this the kind of the drills I would either design myself or help design with other coaches at the start. Again, we probably broke the game down just too much, and they became the starts are too static and predictable and from the same spot every time, and the ball comes in the same way. And then as soon as you're into that game, and then the ball's just coming in slightly different way, or the defender, attacker, say, distance is just slightly varied, which means options and opportunities are slightly different. It doesn't necessarily all fall apart, especially if you're working with good players. They'll still make work, but especially with younger players, you just then see there's often just nothing transfers, or there's this period of almost like having to relearn in-game context again. So there's that period of it might take 10 minutes or so where they're recalibrating to actually this is how it works in game and kind of problem solving, which is okay. So it's not to say maybe they got nothing out of the more isolated kind of static drill. But yeah, I think, again, there's probably that sweet spot. If you look of a continuum, if maybe we could have started a bit closer to what that game looked like by just more varying the way it starts. And I see it a hell of a lot in basketball working on offense, to say so with my lad. Watched him now through from under 12s to just finished under 18, so the last six or 7 years. You see it working on an offensive set. So we break it down every time the ball starts with the point guard in this particular spot. As soon as we scrimmage and now we've got to rebound the ball at one end and we bring it up, it's all over the place and there's no transfer in the coach. Stop, what did we just talk about? But you've just set them up to fail in a way, because what they're now experiencing and again seeing and how the play is unfolding when they're pushing it up after that defensive rebound is nothing like when it's a static start. So that's probably the number one thing I would look at, actually, if I went in and when we're looking at transfer, is if you break it down too much, that's often when you don't see the transfer back into the hole.
And am I wrong in that sense too? It's start with the whole game. And then if you need to break down something, break it down. But we tend to think, oh, we need all these progressions to build up to actually playing the game. But the reality is, and you and I have both probably tested this, but I've done it with 8-year-olds on up. And it's like, they don't need it broken down to start. They actually need the whole picture to start with to just understand why they're even doing anything isolated or breakdown or any type of drill.
Yes, yeah, fantastic point. Again, like there's whole part whole methods. So there are lots of, again, different frameworks and theories would support that as well, because I think it's important to say it's not just, oh, it's one particular theory and or idea. Yeah. So I think that some additions to that about the whole, again, the whole doesn't have to be in basketball terms 5v5, does it? So again, if it's we're working with 8, 9, 10 year olds, I would say again, 3v3 would be a great little way to start with a whole. He's saying, and let's see how that game unfolds. And then maybe you're getting into the part and reducing it down. And maybe it becomes, again, individual shooting or dribbling, whatever the case might be. And then you're back into a 3v3 game. So I think, yeah, it's important when we say the whole, Chris, maybe we're talking again about more and less game-like. So starting more and then maybe going into the part. And second, yeah, completely agree with kids having a sense of how does whatever, if there's a certain skill focus or action I'm learning, like how does it relate to the game context, is start with the game, give them the sense of that, I think is really powerful. And then you're going to see, yeah, back to the transfer idea, then we maybe isolate something, then back into the game can be really powerful. Again, I've seen lots of times where I'll take a soccer example where start off with some unopposed ball manipulation or dribbling ball at your feet. And then the coach will suddenly say, oh, you can't do that. If you did that in a game, the defender would take it off you. Yeah, but there's no defender here to take it off them. So the kids, again, are arguably solving the problem based on the constraints, which is no defense. If you put a defender in, it's again remarkable just what I've observed, how quickly kids start to figure out, actually, if there's a defender close, I'll keep the ball just a bit close to my feet. If I'm
My
in
other favorite
space,
is when they
off
say
the floor.
visualize the defense. Visualize the defense. I'm like, really? Can't we just have defense?
Yeah, exactly. Or yeah, you've got to be faster than that. Again, that's too slow, the defense will shut down. But then that's probably, to be honest, one of my pet peeves, because I think expertise is knowing, often the best players, they know when to go fast and when to go slow. But where does that knowing come from? It's just from experiencing, isn't it? All those interactions with defenders, like thousands and thousands of times. And you just develop that feel for now's the time to go fast, now's the time to pause. Yeah, it's not something that's something I'm pretty big on. They're things that you can't really verbalize those things, like in verbal instruction, as in, yes, that's right, that's wrong. It's got to be experienced, I think, and felt.
Well, to your point, it's like coaches say a lot, game speed. We got to go game speed. We got to go game
Yeah.
speed. But they mean game speed is full intensity. But really, game speed is obviously change of intensity constantly.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it was good. Only last week, though, it was really good. There was a session I was watching. Actually, a female coach, really good. She stopped it, said, "What did you like?" It was actually really good coaching. You know, what was good about this? The players had some good things. They brought up the intensity was really good. She said, "Yep, bang on." But we need to actually at times learn how to still play with control, and at times actually play slower, which is really unusual, particularly in Australian basketball, to hear that. We just need to play a little slower. It was good.
I love that point. And I want to reiterate the point that you made and get some more thoughts on some other ideas. But like you're giving coaches practical ideas, and that's what we're both consumed with, I think, throughout our sharing. And the one that you basically said is that obviously vary the starts. Even if you're going to do the same drill every day, don't do it from the same location every day. Vary it. And then the other one you said is give it context. I'll give you a quick one. We all know the line drills, dribble, jump stop, pivot, pass back to your partner. And every time I see it, it's all these players on the sideline. And the other day when I did a clinic, I said, okay, let's look at a traditional drill and let's see how we can make it better. And how about this? How about we just start it at the 3-point line? They dribble in, they basically do a back pivot, and they pass back to their teammate who relocated outside the 3-point line. And now we're giving it more context. So those are two great ideas. Can you give us some other practical ideas for coaches to be able to make their practices either more representative or more likely to transfer?
And I think you're hitting on a good one there with the back pivot and passing. And because I'm assuming, Chris, there it's like in an unopposed kind of drill, is I think passing is a good one for doing unopposed, but again, allow much more variability in exploration. It was only a chat I had earlier this year with the coach of my lad's team. He was talking about particularly working with girls around 10, 11, 12 year old, where it's still that coordination. It's still quite rigid, that idea of freezing degrees of freedom, say. So still quite rigid with passing the balls. And the same, I think there, like unopposed would still work really well. But again, different size balls, maybe even tennis balls, they just need to learn So to one hand a pass, don't worry about this. The classic chess pass, just get them passing the ball, one hand, two hands, tennis ball, bigger ball, in lots of different ways. You can, you know, over the head, hook passes, just try and unfreeze those degrees of freedom. So I think that's another way where that would be an unopposed situation. But yeah, again, you want your teammate you're passing to be moving at different distances. And it's not going to happen within one session. So when you talk about transfer, it's not, if you do that once for 10 minutes, then, oh, that's for 10-year-old girls, and you know, you've got daughters yourself, Chris, so you speak to this really well. It's not going to happen straight away, but I would say if you do that maybe 10 minutes, two or three times a week over 6 weeks, you'd be surprised how quickly it will have some positive transfer and impact.
And how quickly they come up with their own solutions. I love that you said explore. It's like,
yeah,
before you give them your answers, let them explore their possibilities. And I do encourage, I get asked all the time by coaches, like, how did you help your daughters? And I'm not saying my daughters are good. I'm just saying literally they love basketball. I think in part they love basketball because I haven't restricted them. I haven't limited them. So they throw one hand passes. They try things. They explore things. And it's just, isn't that the fun of it? Like when you were alone in the gym as a youngster, Mark, you probably just said, hey, I'm going to try this and see how it feels and how it works.
Absolutely. I think that's such a key. You can develop that real passion for the sport through like a curiosity, I call it. We probably don't always think of curiosity that way, but I think it is a form of curiosity. As you say, unlock, when kids realize, like, they start exploring and I try this and it doesn't work, but then suddenly it does. It's just that it might be like a subconscious thing about, I wonder what else I can do or try. And yeah, I think it's beautiful if you create that. And then my big thing then is, I think with that, having created that mindset in a way, or that foundation, it just allows you to go and engage with the game potentially for years to come into late adulthood, regardless of the level you get at. I was a 20-year like rec social league player, never got anywhere near serious club competitive basketball. But it was, 20 years of really good fun. And I think that's what you can instill with players, allowed to explore and just develop their skills and engage with the game in that really intrinsically motivating way.
It's beautiful.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
I want to get into so much with you, but I do want to get to some of the shooting stuff, Shoot XP. Maybe remind me to come back if I don't, to the degrees of freedom and the different things that come into play when it comes to shooting as well. Because I think that's something that people are starting to expand their mind a little bit about, the way to teach certain things. There's no perfect technique and it's what works for you, but there are some commonalities. And I think Shoot XP is such a wonderful resource for that. So maybe first talk to us about what Shoot XP is and how you came up with this.
Yeah, it's a combination of looking to provide some professional development, and I guess a lot of it working with coaches. We're ideally working with coaches. It's not something that I necessarily will be working directly with players on. So it's, again, more that step removed, work with coaches, build their capacity or other staff potentially. So it's that, and as well as a tool, an analytical platform that allows you, I touched on it earlier about kind of tracking progressions, and it doesn't necessarily have to be sophisticated, but it's got some of that built in. Yeah, a little bit of the AI stuff to, in some situations in practice, be able to automate detecting shots and made baskets, as well as add a bit more context. Was the shot contested if we're doing a one-on-one, say, shooting workout? So there's a little bit of that, but I don't want to overplay that. I know everyone's like talking about AI, or the big tech companies want to tell you that AI is going to change the world or make you a miraculous coach or whatever. I probably underplay it a little bit, but it's got a bit of that in there. But I think the idea is to have a tool that, alongside maybe learning about some of these principles we've touched on, how to design effective practices transfer, is a way to track some of that and have a bit of data there, have it linked to video potentially, and just combine those two together in what I call, I guess, action learning type approach to coach development, professional development. Equally, if you're flying and you're across all the constraint stuff and you're really into already the shooting sessions you're doing, it's a tool that you could just use yourself and don't necessarily need me. So that's a high level snapshot of it, Chris.
So it's a way for a player, in theory, to be able to evaluate their shot, improve their shot, and work within kind of technology to be able to help assist that.
Yeah, exactly. But and I guess trying to look it back to context to what some of the contextual variables or constraints we can look at. I know there's other systems and tools that will give you a bit more about your actual biomechanics or potentially systems like NOAA that are going to give you the arc and direction and more micro stuff. I've tried to build it in yeah, a bit more about, are you on the move before you shoot left or right? Again, that is it a contested shot? Potentially how far away was that defender? So a bit more of those contextual variables. How much variability? If you do a shooting workout, there's a simple kind of chart that will show you, are you shooting from the same spot for 10 in a row, or you're consistently changing spots? And when you change your location, do you hit that first shot from a new location, or does it take you two or three to get your eye in, which arguably could be a bit of an better indicator of like in-game shooting if we agree that rarely will you shoot two shots in a row within 10 seconds from exactly the same spot in a real game.
Rarely, almost never, let's be honest. I
Yeah,
mean,
it
almost
does
never.
happen occasionally, doesn't it?
Yeah,
Yeah,
I
almost
know.
never. Once a season.
But we practice that way all the time
Yeah,
shooting, and I
all
know
the time.
that's something. And like, again, you've seen some of the videos with my daughter. Like, she's a science experiment for the world. Like, I'm just literally trying different things every day. And I want to hear your opinions on this because I feel she's very adaptable. And now, to your point, getting her repeatable with that adaptability is that next level a little bit. That ability to be able to, okay, change quickly and then it doesn't faze her. She's able to make that next shot. And I only use her as an example because a lot of coaches have watched the video of it. But it's a fun process, isn't it? To be able to use constraints to be able to shape shooting.
There was actually a research paper that came out recently. I think we talked about Adam Gorman earlier, that shows there's a hell of a lot you can do just in one-on-one shooting. So again, shooting doesn't have to be in 5v5. And I know the work that some of the videos I've seen with your daughter, and I'd be the same with my son. We've done just as a lot, just it's a one-on-one shooting workout, but manipulating constraints in different ways. And yeah, and it's a constant experiment. It sounds, I don't know how you feel, Chris, when you talk about experimenting on your kids in a way. Like I feel the same, but also hesitate at the same time. But you are doing that. I don't think you can help it once you dive in that rabbit
She doesn't
hole a
like
little
that
bit.
word, so, but I think she
No.
does appreciate the method.
Yes. But it is a good reality check though, because arguably you as a parent, like probably your kids better than any coach will. And in your case, Chris, given the coaching expertise you also have, yet I find it still quite challenging. Like you still never feel like you've solved it, or you know that, okay, just do this, and in 6 months we're going to get this result. So that uncertainty, and therefore as a coach that, you know, or as a parent, the need to be adaptable and comfortable with some of that uncertainty, I think is also a big challenge and part of this as a coach or parent.
I love that you said that. For me, that's such a huge part of this is that I don't feel like we've ever solved anything. I don't have the answer, but you know what we do? We keep exploring. We keep trying to figure it out. And in that process has been so beautiful. But with Shoot XP and all your expertise, what are some things that you've learned about shooting that you think we should think about a little bit more?
Yeah, I think we're underestimating the variables that get thrown up in a game. The defender's the obvious one, but it is key that just rushes us or makes us have to shoot a bit quicker. So we've got to generate force or power quicker, or quiet eye. So we haven't really got into that, but the concept of the quiet eye, which is that really fixating on the hoop, which is easy to do when we do unopposed, to really lock in. But again, it only takes some other things happening in the environment for that to just take our attention for a split second. And again, some of the research would show that can often make a big difference in your shooting. So there's all these subtle things, and again, variations, dynamic things happening in a game that probably even sometimes to naked eye, it's not really obvious what it's doing to the shooter. But we often can tell by the result, because we come back to, in practice, you could shoot at 70%, in the game you're at 30%, what the hell is going on? So we know stuff is going on. And I think we just underestimate the need to incorporate more of that variability into our practice. We're probably talking about a bit more advanced now, aren't they? Once shooters have got to a certain level of stability and consistency, we're not probably talking about 6 or 8 year olds here. It's probably more 15, 16 onwards that, for me, we probably don't challenge them enough. And again, maybe just as I'm saying that, not specific to basketball, if I'm thinking as well, Aussie rules with same thing, shooting a goal there whilst you're punting the ball, often we still tack it on as like just some reps at the end of training or in between. We're not intentional and really deliberate enough about what arguably is the key skill, because it's most closely correlated with actually putting a score on the board. Again, whether that's basketball, Aussie rules, soccer, you name it, basically anything that involves shooting at a goal. I think there's a bit of a common trend of just not putting the time back to the time and thought maybe required.
I love that you brought that up, because I do think that's a challenge for coaches. I want them to feel good about themselves. I want them to make a lot of shots, and the difference between that and struggling to improve, that you need to have optimal struggle to improve, to be challenged.
Yeah, really interesting point, Chris. I don't know what you're saying with players you've worked with and your daughters. I think there's and again, probably through the teenage years, and if you are aspirational, trying to prove yourself, I think there's a really difficult period. Again, a Rick Shuttleworth image talks about the learning pit. So you get to this point in your journey, you want to get up here, but to get there, you've got to go down into this learning pit where it's messy and uncomfortable, when you're probably like questioning, am I good enough? But you struggle through that, and then you take that jump up. And I think there's a real period there where sometimes young players don't necessarily want to be challenged, or aren't up for the challenge, because they're trying to show that they're good. They don't want their weaknesses exposed. And again, the earlier we have selection or supposedly high-level competition at younger ages, the more in that can come up. You create that bit of insecurity of I can't look bad. I've got to look super confident all the time. And I think that's difficult. But once I think a player kind of gets that point of then like comfortable that, I'm half decent. Now, how can I get even better? That's then when they can really step in. And I've seen that again with young professional players coming in into the professional game as well.
It's such an outstanding point. I'm just nodding my head the whole time you're saying that, particularly the part about sometimes they just want to see it go in. They want to feel good.
Yeah.
Like sometimes
I
add too much variability for my daughters. And I know they're just sometimes like, can I just make a few shots? Like doing what you said to do, instead of like constantly changing it up. And it's taught me a great lesson about that it's okay to only have two different things for variability, and don't have to have seven they made a few shots. Now I've got to make it harder. Sometimes it's okay to just feel good about yourself.
Yeah, it fits for sure. And also as well, it brings into mind like those different challenge levels, I guess just drifting a little bit, Chris, from your original question, but different levels of challenge. And I think when you are playing competitive games too, for youth players coming through, it's probably good at times where you play in a game or a comp where, you're pretty good. You know you're better than the rest and you're quite comfortable there and maybe explore a bit. Then you have other opportunities where it's pretty even, you match just right. And then maybe as well at times though where you're quite stretched. So maybe you're playing with players who are 2 or 3 years older or just that next level advanced, and you get that real sense of, right, this is what that next level looks like. And I think if you can, there's an experience, a mix of all those as well, is gives you quite a nice balance.
I love that. And a few places I want to go, but I just quickly, and I could be completely wrong, but one of my interpretations, having dove into that research, I think Joan Vickers first exposed it to me ages ago. But it's like this concept of the longer you can keep your gaze on the target, say on a layup, the more likely you're to make it. Even if I'm going under the rim, I should still be looking back at the target. And the example I want to have you talk about a little bit more is that almost all these shooting drills trainers and kids are doing, their only gaze is on the target. And the reality that you brought up already is like, the last thing I look at on the layup is literally the target, because I'm scanning for the defender. I'm scanning for my teammates being open. I'm scanning for the help. And then we practice all these things in isolation with our gaze only on the target, shooting and layups and et cetera. So maybe dive a little bit deeper into that for us.
Yeah, so it's back to what I said about if you break something down too much, and then say in this example, Chris, then we don't have to switch our gaze, or maybe we'd probably more often talk about switching attentional focus. So saying there's no requirement to switch from, just that defender who's closing me out, half an eye on them, as well as starting to lock in on the hoop. There's no need for that. But arguably, again, that's maybe where the real expertise and back to being able to adapt to the dynamics of the game is that quick switching of attention and learning to do that. And again, very much that like subconscious process, and you become more efficient at how to do that. Or it's been a while since I've had to use the term. I think it's also called at times like anchoring fixation. So say, but this might be more if you're dribbling, again, could be basketball, could be soccer, maybe, and there's a gap between two defenders, that you, rather than scan to look at both, you anchor your attention right in the middle and use more of your peripheral vision. So essentially be watching both at the same time. And again, I'm not saying anyone should ever try and explicitly teach like that as a method of scanning or directing attention, but it tends to just happen. You learn that if I just anchor my attention center in the center, I can keep these two defenders or opponents in my peripheral vision, and again make that judgment about, is that gap dribble throughable? We talk about affordances, I suppose that's where ideas like affordances would come in. Does that afford actually dribbling through, or are they going to close that up?
I love it. I'll throw some simpler examples. If somebody's going to drive to the basket, all I have to do, say in a team practice or an individual practice, is one time I step in front of them as they're going in. And then every other time they go in for a layup, they're basically looking to me first in case that happens. So it's like a real simple way. And another one for like shooting is, instead of passing from right under the basket, pass from a side and be variable where you pass from. So they have to look at where you are first and where they're going to receive the ball. And I say these as like simple things, but I know they're not simple because, again, it's just taking people a little bit out what they're traditionally doing. But what you said and what I've said throughout, these things are very actionable, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. And that raises a good one too, is I said just stepping in once or twice. Now the players having to pay attention, which they said also means that, when I don't step in and you have that completely uncontested drive, or in outside shooting, say, where actually there is no contest, which we know happens, you can still have those, but they have much greater value because they're saying like it's not pre-known in advance that it's going to be uncontested. It's still a decision or a perception that I have to make. I still have to perceive, actually I am open. And maybe again, I can just take a fraction of a second more to settle, balance, knock it down. Whereas if I already know pre-planned that I'm wide open, everything kind of changes. To look at it doesn't look like it is, but it does. The whole thing changes,
which is in a way simple. If you can just do something that they don't know the answer in advance, it's more game like
I think that's another, just again, Rick Shuttleworth was big on that. If there's some real simple take-home points, that's another one. Try not to have anything pre-planned. The players as minimal amount of times as possible where they already know what they're going to do or know what's going to happen. Try and minimize that.
Finishing this list, the three common problems in player development, we said too much copy and paste, practice doesn't transfer to games, and then the last point is difficult to measure what is valuable. So talk to us about that one.
Yeah, so that I guess that's, back to kind of skill. I think the rest of that was, really what we've been talking about here, links to the transfer bit to game. Like, what is skill really? It's being able to arguably solve problems that the game, the real game, is going to throw at you.
But people think a skill is just technique, and that's part of the problem.
Exactly, it's an ongoing thing. It's been... Sometimes language matters, Chris, doesn't it? Sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it does. And it's unfortunately, and probably for the skill acquisition discipline too, which is a struggle to maybe get a real foothold after 20 odd years, some of it comes back to just this people's definition and interpretation of skill, which is interesting. But Yeah, it's how do we measure or evaluate skill in a game context, which can be trickier because, like I said, there's all these contextual variables and things are constantly changing. And that angle is probably also a response, and this is more now probably at the pro level, and I know actually it's become very topical over there too, things like load management. But particularly here in Australia, like with all the GPS and player tracking that actually I was involved in nearly 25 years ago when that got started, that shows I'm getting on a bit, mate. But that's become all that physical data, tracking, load management data has become so massive. But I feel like it's crowding out, like again, for team or ball or what you might call skill-based sports, like skill is still the thing that separates is what expertise is largely going to be built on. And it felt like that was starting to be crowded out. And again, with youth players or in longer-term player development, and particularly here in Australia, to be progressive was, oh yeah, we're doing load management. Yeah, what are you doing to even track your shooting and design effective shooting? Oh yeah, they put up 100 shots after training. Like I think we're losing sight of it. So as much as I'm not one that we have to have data and you have to be able to measure everything to manage it, I'm not on that at all. I think good observation gets you a long way. But having some different data points to throw in there that are more skill related, I think can just change our focus a little bit or maybe reorient us back to a pretty important aspect of team sports and obviously basketball.
It's such a great point. And you mentioned this challenge with kind of technique and skill and understanding those two things. I'm getting this a little bit, that they're interpreting it as, oh, this is what coaches used to do. They just used to scrimmage a lot. You know what I'm saying? That's not what we're saying. We're not saying just scrimmage. You mentioned some pet peeves earlier as well. So maybe you can go down either of those roads. But what are some other things that you feel we kind of misinterpret or maybe we should be getting along better with at this point?
And that's probably back to what you brought up earlier around the importance of trying to individualize constraints. I feel like what you've just said there gets back into just generic a task constraint for this game or drill. We're largely scrimmaging, and I might have one rule, like you have to kick ahead, for example. We've been doing that for years. And I think that is interesting is, and again, it's often I think if a coach responds like that, it's a good opportunity to think, why are they responding like that? That's how they're truly interpreting it. And there's more to do to unpack it a bit more or to show maybe, no, that's not exactly what we're talking about, or there's more depth to it. And although at times, I think it can be a bit of a like a protective mechanism because again, back to uncertainty and feeling a bit of insecurity as a coach, it's, oh, I'm not sure about this. We've always done this. Kind of just clinging on to that's what I know, which is it's again, we all will do it in different situations. So it's probably just if I'm doing coach development work, it's probably just trying to tease those things out a little bit more, which goes into working with coaches. It is a patient process. We talked about earlier about young players being curious and really exploring. Same with coaches. You really want them to engage. So then you've got to be really careful of being bull at a gate, I think. Ideally, you want coaches coming to you. That doesn't always happen. And particularly when you get into sometimes consultancy and project work, you're parachuted into an environment and the coaches might not necessarily be that receptive to start with. So it's similar though to working with players, like how do you make it feel as safe as possible? Let again, autonomy, let the coaches, what do they want to explore or where do they want to start even? So even if it is, oh yeah, we've been doing scrimmages with putting some rules on for years. Yeah, great. Talk to me about what you've been doing. What's worked? What have you found worked? What maybe hasn't worked? And then you just maybe run with that a little bit.
I'd love to talk consulting with you because I'm nodding my head the whole time you're saying that. And generally, it's again, it's meet people a little bit where they're at and then ask them questions and then help shape a little bit more what they're already doing. But also, I find, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, marrying ideas almost like this is a traditional drill you did. Here's how you can still do it and yet marry it a little bit with some of these modern ideas around constraints and. Maybe it's a as simple as this. It's like a drill to live. I go to people, I say, okay, do your drill, but then do it to live play somehow. So it's a dynamic start to live play. And it's again, I get it. It's not fully ecological, it's not fully constraint led, but it marries the two things between coaches that are somewhat not there yet, but are exploring it. And I love that idea, but curious your thoughts on that, but maybe some other ideas like that for coaches to feel less threatened. We don't want them to be threatened by this. This isn't a threat. This just adds value for them and helps them be better.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And I've seen videos, Chris, of you doing exactly that. You'll demonstrate, okay, here's the traditional, what we've all done. Here's just one thing we can do. And when I watch those, like, yes, that is already 1,000 times better from, but kind of biased perspective in a way. But yeah, exactly. Make it as easy as possible. And I think, and again, because like coaching is big and broad, and we all know there's a lot that you got to do and cover and a lot going on in coaching. To be able to, whether it's a skill acquisition specialist or someone who's particularly interested in skill development, player development, practice sessions, you've got the luxury of benefit. You've zoomed in on just one piece of coaching. So I think we always have to appreciate there's a hell of a lot of other stuff going on. And whether that piece of coaching is really what this particular coach or coaching group are super engaged about is something I'm trying to judge. And so if they're not, like, that's fine. Like, you're not trying to force someone to be, you need to be super passionate about this area. So it's just maybe some small wins, some gains, and then there's other areas that they're more into or more higher priority at the moment for them and their team or environment. But then I think most environments I've been into with multiple coaches, there's normally at least one coach who's like, you can just tell they're into this, and they might be a bit quiet in a group setting, but after they'll come up or they'll email you. It's like they're the ones that there's some, we could go somewhere here, and you can really start to push them. And I think that's what we need more of. I know it's topical here in Australia a little bit. I was involved with the RAS with kind of the skill acquisition discipline and where that might be going a couple of years ago. I'm more of a push for, I think for those coaches who are really passionate about it, I think we need more coaches who have a really solid, like a 7 out of 10 understanding of this. And we'll still always need a skill acquisition specialist who's got a 9 or 10 out of 10 understanding of the area. But I think we need to find and support those coaches who want to really explore the area.
Well, and again, you must find this because I find this, and you've been sharing it for a very long time, that now we're multiple degrees of separation from certain people, us having influenced or them having learned these phrases or these different things. And it is coming along, and it's beautiful in a way that it's happening. But I know I sit in a space sometimes where I'm a little impatient about sometimes still having to argue on behalf of playing basketball helps you get better at basketball. And I just, I say it with a little smile, but still, really, I have to defend the fact that we should play more basketball in practice and do less drills like three-man weave, zigzag drill, etc. And I'm like, where are these people defending three-man weave? Like, how are you defending that? We've always done it. This different thing. So I'm curious from your perspective, what are some arguments that I can make or you can make on behalf of this?
Yeah, and three-man weave, gee, that's a classic, isn't it, to probably start with? And you've alluded to it already there. Why are we doing that? Why are you doing that? Where's that come from? And it just creates a great opportunity to maybe start to get coaches to reflect and to critically think a bit more. If you look at, I guess, the broader research and literature on coaching, that's probably what researchers would be most critical of themselves in coaching, is the lack of reflective practice and critical thinking. But a bit back to the copy and paste stuff. So that's not a personal attack on any individual coach. I'm more saying coaching, how coaching has evolved historically, is probably lacking in some of that. If we're doing a three-man weave, it's just a good opportunity to say, why are we doing that? Why do you do that? Where's that come from? I always think it's really interesting to trace back now. I used to, as a kid, I remember, Chris, like just having no interest in history whatsoever or what's going on in the past. Now I understand everything's connected, like the past to the present to the future. And so what's the history of anything we do? Where's that come from? And what time did it emerge? And probably when it did emerge, often I find, and this is not just in basketball or sport or whatever, when it did emerge, there's a really good reason. And it, whatever the thing is, was probably quite effective and a good thing to do in that time and place and era. And yet often we can be 100 plus years later and we're still... the legacy of that is still strong when the context now of the current time and era might be quite different. So I think just having coaches reflect on why they're doing what they're doing, what's some of the history of where that thing's come from.
Kevin Melke, who does a lot of stuff in Ireland with different sports that I don't fully understand, but his writing is tremendous as well. And like a modern version of you, where he's sharing so much wonderful stuff, but he connects a lot of this stuff. And I agree with this when he raised some of these points, and I'm sure I've read some of the stuff from different people through the time, but connects this history back to a lot of the way we teach sport comes from the world wars, the Industrial Revolution, where we wanted very orderly people in physical education. We wanted lines. We wanted them to learn to act like military people, basically, because they might go into the military. So to me, it made sense back then. Again, that's not what we're doing now. We're trying to have players have the best experience possible, athlete satisfaction, enjoyment, and standing in a line, for example, is one of the simplest things to change. Just get rid of lines. And the practice will be more engaging for players.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. And back to where we started this conversation, Chris, the perspective of particularly young players, like that's another one for the coach. Are you aware of how they're experiencing or what their thoughts are? So again, we would say it's probably the basics, but what do players think about the session? Would they keep coming back if the session just ran, if they were going to experience that for the whole year? Would they want to come back? Would they be enthusiastic about it? Yes or no? I think it ties into that, because we could, and how often, and I've seen it quite a bit as well. It's amazing. Like this against kind of to the power of coaching culture of how I've worked quite a bit with former players who transition into typically assistant coaching roles to start their coaching career. And within 6 months, they'll be doing something that we'll have a chat about and they'll go, yeah, as a player, I hated when coaches did that. Now you're doing it already.
And I often ask people all the time, do you do three-man weave before you play pickup? No, of course not. I didn't like it. Why are you having your players do it?
Or did you enjoy long meetings or film reviews that ran for an hour where the coach just, you know, criticized or had 20 negative clips to show? You know, no one really enjoyed those. You tolerated them or you hated them.
And this comes back to you being a neo-generalist. So I want you to talk about that, because I do think too often we just accept what somebody else did and someone else taught us, and we don't question it and we don't ask, is there a better way? And we don't spend time with a lot of these things. So maybe just talk to us a little bit. What does that mean, you're a neo-generalist?
Yeah, good question, Chris. I don't know sometimes. Maybe it's time to move on from that term. No, in seriousness, so there a couple of guys wrote a book a few years ago called The Neo-Generalist, Kenneth Mickelson and Richard Martin, that was just interviewing a range of people that had these varied experiences and multi-skill sets in different domains or professions even throughout their life. So it's a bit of a counter to, I guess, like the jack of all trades but master of none. It's saying actually you could be a master of a few different trades, is the idea of a neo-generalist. So it's not just you know a bit about a whole heap of things, it's arguably actually you have hopefully a reasonable depth of knowledge across different areas. And it's back to then, I guess, the benefit of the idea of then joining the dots between these different domains or kind of things that you're aware of or have some depth of understanding, that you can suddenly join the dots or just see things a little bit different. That's the premise of the book and their use of the term, or coming up with the term, the neo-generalist. Maybe it's just a ego thing for me that just gives me some confidence that I like to just explore different areas.
I know we're going everywhere with this, but it does, when I reread kind of your blog on it, reread a little bit about it, like it does to me, it's in support of coaches, because I do think it's really, have you encountered difficulties describing what you do to other people? Doesn't that just to a T describe coaching?
Yeah. Like
people that don't truly understand coaching, I never get into it with them. I'm just, I coach basketball. They're like, oh, so, you know, you go to practice and you run a practice. And that's their only thought of it. And it's no, absolutely not. And then the other part is, have you ever labeled yourself just to be understood? I'm a basketball coach. And isn't that just an oversimplification of what we do?
Yeah, exactly. And Chris, think of whether it's someone like Popovich or Steve Kerr or Phil Jackson. Think of what they bring to the table as well about, again, their like life experiences or perspectives that they bring. And I think they've all talked about it's not, in the end, it's actually not really about basketball. That's what we do and rock up for every day, but actually it's not about that. And I think the great coaches all bring that some other perspective, don't they, to it, or different experience, and make it broader. And they don't necessarily, again, force that down people's throats, but at the right time, and again, whether it's through their ability to tell a story that's really meaningful from some other domain or context, I think that's definitely a key part of like high-level coaching. I like, ironically, isn't it, to go against the kind of cliche, it's just that you're a super technical expert. Yeah, how to coach the mechanics of shooting. Like it's almost 180 to that.
And you see it, like I've read it in so many autobiographies or biographies, and I feel like it impacted my career in my 30s when I quit studying basketball and studied other things. I feel like I became the better coach. The best version of myself as a coach was when I quit studying basketball because I had that foundation, I had that stuff, and now I went into other domains and business and other these areas, and it just connected for me, and I feel like I see that in so many biographies of great coaches.
And it's an interesting one. It was when I went over to the UK and got involved in the Olympic system over there with coach development. It was an interesting one. I remember about, again, the transition straight from athlete to coach is in years gone by, and maybe now going back a couple of decades, like most coaches have had to hold down a job outside of basketball, or they've certainly had some life experience outside of the sport. And we're just balancing that off now when now, again, in Olympic system, whether it's athletes, in pro sports, it's the professional players go straight from playing. So often they'll get drafted, recruited at 18, play till 30, early 30s, and then straight into a coaching role. They've actually had quite a narrow life experience in one way, like really rich in another.
Mark, this has been incredibly enjoyable. I'm not sure if other people are enjoying it as much as I am, but man, this is absolutely great and I can't wait to talk to you more. But where can people connect with you more? Because I've been so influenced by you and I'm so grateful for you. I know if you just Google Mark's name, Mark Upton on Google, you'll find like blogs and podcasts from so many different places. You've been all over the place sharing and I'm so grateful for that. But for us, the audience, where can we connect with you, and what's the best way to be able to learn more from you?
Yeah, probably just drop me an email at the moment, Chris, mark@shootxp.com. Yeah, with anything, if anything's piqued your interest. The Shoot XP stuff is a bit of a side project at the moment, and I'm happy and looking to collaborate with people. If people are curious about it, by all means, get in touch and have a chat. But really, if there's anything that's come up in a conversation, drop me an email and I'll do my best. And Chris, I know actually, whatever they drop, Chris, it's likely you've covered it at some point with the amazing work you do as well. So between the two of us, we'll cover it off.
Well, I would love that. And we'll collaborate again on a few things and just
Yeah.
help coaches. That's the bottom line. You've done that for ages and we're all grateful for you. So thank you for sharing the game with us.
Thanks, Chris. It's been great being on finally.